welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking about the most recent police murders in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Tulsa, Oklahoma, and calls for justice by the community members, and a little bit about President Obama's last speech as president of the United Nations. But before we can move on, well, here we go again. Mass outrage erupted into clashes between protesters and police and something of an uprising in Charlotte, North Carolina, on the night of September 20th into the morning on the 21st, which is making big headlines for the alleged 16 cops who suffered minor injuries. The anger erupted after the police killed Keith Lamont Scott on Tuesday in yet another incident where police actions are in question. There are a few issues. There are a few questions that are still out there. One, of course, is what exactly happened. And there are, as is often the case in these types of situations, two competing narratives. What we can say for sure, though, is the police were searching an apartment complex for someone who was not Keith Lamont Scott, and Scott was sitting in his car when police arrived. Now, the police story they claim is that they saw Scott exit his car with a gun, go back to his car, then get back out again. Now, mind you, North Carolina is an open carry gun state, meaning that there is nothing illegal per se in what Scott may have done. However, the police claim that they also told him to drop his gun before shooting him, claiming, I guess, that he was some sort of threat and perhaps he had brandished the weapon. However, they're being somewhat cagey, the police, now on the exact details. However, so it's not quite clear how it went down. What we do know is there is video footage from some police body cameras and dashboard cameras, although the officer who fired the shot was not wearing a body camera. Scott's family says that he was reading a book in the car and did not have a gun. We're going to have to wait for more to come out to know for sure, but as it concerns the stormy protest of the stormy protest that took place earlier in the week, the details are in some way beside the point. This is the sixth person killed by a police officer in the past year in Charlotte. All five were, not surprisingly, found to be justified, the five before this. One recent shooting, for instance, in the Charlotte area you may remember was that of Daniel Harris, the deaf man, killed by police for not understanding their commands. So as it concerns policing per se, we have to take a step back and recognize that Charlotte, like just about everywhere else, has a long line of police killings that prime the pump for anger in cases like these. But looking just a touch deeper, we can see even more, as we pointed out in regards to Baltimore and Milwaukee, the communities erupting in anger are highly impoverished and essentially ignored. And Charlotte tells a similar story. For instance, while on the one hand, Charlotte is responsible for 30% of North Carolina's GDP, and has 25% of households making $100,000 or more a year, poverty has also doubled since the year 2000, and more than one-third of Charlotte's census tracts are considered to be high poverty. 36% of black children and 39% of Latino children are living in poverty in Charlotte, and in a sign of how that sort of inequality grows, 85% of all job growth is either low-wage or high-wage, with the low-wage jobs having stagnant or falling salary levels. So in other words, Charlotte is a stark city of the haves and have-nots, which makes it not so surprising that Walmart was targeted by some, not only one of the principal low-wage employers in this country, but also a symbol of the existence of a massive low-wage workforce in this country that can only really shop at places like Walmart. Or, you know, that trucks on the highway would be stripped of their goods, or just in an overall sense that people would explode in anger. Urban communities in America are like a pot set to boil, stripped of job opportunities, mired in mass incarceration and militarized policing, pathologized for being responsible for all of their own problems, and thus denied adequate services. Charlotte, just like Ferguson, Baltimore, or Milwaukee, was primed for this sort of thing. It was only a matter of time before the pot boiled over. The United States Department of Justice has now opened an investigation into the murder of Terrence Crutcher. This was a police killing so egregious that even Donald Trump said it was unjustified. Video of the incident from several different angles gives us much more of a sense of what happened in this case. Crutcher, a 40-year-old man and a father of four, was leaving his music appreciation class at a local community college when his car broke down on the highway. As one 911 call put it, Crutcher was also warning motorists his car may explode. Either way, Officer Betty Shelby, who fired the fatal shots, came upon the scene en route to another call. According to her own account pre-video, Shelby asked Crutcher if it was his car and got no response, then walked towards her with his hands in his pockets. At her request, he removed his hands from his pockets. He then, understandably, put his hands up. She then drew her gun and ordered him to get on his knees. Instead, Crutcher starts walking back towards his car. As this is all happening, more officers were gathering, and there is a police officer in a helicopter overhead. In one police helicopter video, you can hear the cop saying from way up in the air that Crutcher was a, quote, bad dude. How he determined that is unknown, but perhaps gives some sense of the mentality these officers had. Next, what we see in the video is that Crutcher is walking back to his car with his hands up, followed by Shelby and three other officers. They claim he reached into his car, which is why one shot him with a taser and another, Shelby, with a gun, and it was Shelby's gunshots that ultimately killed Crutcher, who was left bleeding in the street. Clearly, Crutcher should not have been killed. While the police are now spinning a story that he was high on PCP, and who knows, maybe he was, they clearly made no real attempt to subdue him. Further, even from Officer Shelby's own accounts, he was entirely compliant when she asked him to remove his hands from his pockets, and his non-compliance consisted of him walking away with his hands up. Once again, it was a shoot-first, ask-questions-later situation, and clearly the facts as we know it now show that there had to have been another way to do it. I mean, as attorney Benjamin Crump has pointed out, how is it that the guy who set two bombs over the weekend was captured alive, but Terrence Crutcher, an innocent man, was shot and left for dead in the streets of Oklahoma? And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined as we continue this conversation by journalist Samantha Vicent of the Tulsa World, and she is the night police and breaking news reporter for the Tulsa World. Samantha, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
No, of course, of course. And so I was wondering for our listeners if you could just set the scene for us a little bit now in Tulsa. It's been a few days since the video of Terrence Crutcher being killed has been released. There have been sort of statements from all sides made about this. I mean, where do we stand right now in terms of what's happening?
Okay, so for those who may not know, although there's a very small chance of that at this point, Friday night around 7:45 p.m. in North Tulsa, which is a predominantly African-American part of our community, Officer Betty Shelby, who's been with the agency since 2011, shot 40-year-old Terrence Crutcher once during his vehicle had been stopped for some reason. His family says that his vehicle had broken down in the middle of the road in North Tulsa. Officers got two phone calls indicating that it was blocking traffic, but Officer Shelby was not aware necessarily of those calls. She had been en route to an unrelated call whenever she happened upon Mr. Crutcher's vehicle in the middle of the road. And she says that he jumped out or approached her and kind of made a sudden movement. Her attorney has since told us that she believed through her drug recognition training that she's done that he had been under the influence of PCP at the time. He was not armed, as our local police chief, Jeff Jordan, told us during a Monday news conference. Police released Tuesday that they found a vial of PCP in the vehicle that I don't even think has been field tested or tested by our state criminology lab. It's just based on field test results. And they don't know whether it was in a system because we haven't received a tox screen or a full autopsy report.
And so in terms of where things are in terms of the community itself, I think one thing that a lot of folks are seeing and talking about is what's happening in North Carolina related to a police shooting there. I mean, what has been the community's response so far in Tulsa? Have there been protests? Not really. Vigils? I mean, what's going on there?
What makes Tulsa a little different from a lot of other cities, maybe of its size or larger cities, is that protests or demonstrations that have gone on here have been through an open line of communication with our local law enforcement, at least for the most part. We've had several demonstrations since Friday that have walked to the police station chanting all the hands up, don't shoot, Black Lives Matter, all of those kinds of things. The largest is probably around 500 people or so. We have had occasional in the past for other incidents where they've gone into the road and made a statement, but we haven't had any damage or any confrontations with law enforcement as a result of these protests or anything relating to them at all. Our law enforcement mostly just lets the protesters do their thing.
Do you feel that this is something that community response? I mean, you know, we were looking at some of the information here when we were preparing for this show, and we saw that last year Oklahoma was number one per capita in deaths caused by police. I mean, is there a certain numbness to this type of thing? Is it considered routine? I think around the country there's so much outrage around this situation. I mean, are people there sort of similarly shocked by this, or does it seem like in context perhaps maybe not so shocking for folks who are in Tulsa?
Oklahoma, since 2007, we ran a story on this, I believe today, has had about 160 shootings by law enforcement, only two of which have resulted in any kind of prosecution of the officer who killed the person. One of those was in Del City, Oklahoma, which is a suburb of Oklahoma City, and the other was the shooting of Eric Harris last year by a Tulsa County Reserve deputy who has been convicted of second-degree manslaughter and is now in prison for it. We have not gotten a whole lot of surprise feedback from readers in regards to the findings made as a result of these incidents. The Tulsa Police Department has had four of them this year. One of those has so far been cleared and the officer since returned to work. The other two are still pending investigations, and our local homicide unit hasn't announced just a decision. But the Robert Bates shooting last April kind of surprised a lot of people here because he ended up being charged with second-degree manslaughter, and people weren't sure what was going to happen. They thought that the video footage in that incident made a difference in whether he was charged or not, and that could play a role in the Terrence Crutcher shooting, because there are multiple videos that show very clearly what happened and how the facts shown on that video differ from initial statements given by police on Friday.
Mm-hmm. And one thing, there is quite a bit of video that I think a number of us have seen from the helicopter, I believe a dashboard cam. One thing I wasn't clear on, did the officers in this case potentially have body cameras? And if not, do you expect that to become part of the discussion in terms of sort of the what's next, what are the solutions type of thing that always comes up here?
Our officers currently don't have body cameras. We have received a federal grant of, I believe, more than $500,000 to have them, but due to a bunch of administrative work and bureaucracy, we have not had those instituted at this point. Not even all of our patrol cars have dash cams. Officer Shelby's dash cam wasn't in use at the time off of the shooting because officers told us that there is a 3-switch toggle system and she only had it on the first switch. The second and third would lead to the dash cam being activated, but the first, which just turns on some lights, does not.
Well, that's interesting. Interesting system. So, I guess then to some degree, it probably seems like this will become a big part of the conversation in the wake of this, is this issue of, you know, how do you turn the cameras on? How do you not? That seems like that'll be a big takeaway, don't you think?
Yes. Some other smaller law enforcement agencies who've had these types of situations this year, I've covered some in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, and in Wagoner, Oklahoma. And those officers, all of them have body cams. And those were all released to us within a week or so of the incident. So I think Tahlequah actually kind of set an example last June of 2015, whenever they released a police shooting video within 3 or 4 days. And since then, for the most part, it hasn't been more than a week or two, which kind of stands out.
Yeah.
Charlotte is obviously not releasing its footage, citing a law that has not yet gone into effect.
Yes, no, very, very interesting, especially since according to the Charlotte police, they have quite a bit of video, even though the officer who killed someone didn't have their body camera on, but I guess three others did, and they had a dash cam video. So we'll see how long that lasts. But nevertheless, I think it's an interesting question, you know, maybe more notably and where we're talking nationally about all of these different questions. And I wonder, you know, what has been the reaction to, speaking of the national level, to the Department of Justice deciding to open this investigation? I mean, has it been something that's been welcomed, or perhaps are folks a little wary?
People are very happy, for lack of a better way of saying it, that there is a Department of Justice inquiry being done. Tulsa police and Oklahoma City police are unique in that they conduct their own investigation into these incidents. Most of our other agencies outsource the investigation of the shooting itself to an agency called the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, which files its report and submits it to the local district attorney's office, which then determines whether to initiate criminal charges. And so the Department of Justice involvement gives at least a semblance of impartiality that I don't think would be there if it were simply local law enforcement looking into the incident.
And how do you expect this, if at all, to impact on the maybe statewide politics? I mean, I know Oklahoma is a quote-unquote red state. I mean, what we saw in the wake of what took place in Baltimore is that the Maryland state legislature immediately started moving a package around police reform issues. They said they wouldn't have done it if it wouldn't have been for Baltimore. I mean, do you expect any sort of sea change in the state legislature there to deal with this, or maybe not?
We have had even some pretty outspoken conservatives come out in, you know, questioning this, the circumstances of the shooting and reform. I think there's a sense of a bit more urgency this time around. We had some of these discussions after the Eric Harris shooting last year. Since that was about 18 months or so ago, not a whole lot has changed since then. So I think this time around we'll have a little more urgent discussion. And if conservatives here have started getting on board, our mayor, I think, even went on NPR this morning saying that the shooting bothered him. We will see what happens.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much for joining the show. That was Samantha Veason of the Tulsa World. She's a journalist there who's been covering it, and we'll have more on this story as it breaks here on By Any Means Necessary. We're going to take a break, but we will be back with more. You're listening to us on Radio Sputnik here in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're continuing our conversation talking about the recent police murder of Terrence Crutcher that happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and calls for justice coming from community members and the situation down there in Tulsa. And we are very happy to be joined by Dr. Rodney Goss, who is the pastor of Morning Star Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Dr. Goss, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a privilege.
No, of course, of course. And so you were one of the first people to see the video that many of us now, millions of folks have seen, of Mr. Crutcher being killed, along with some other local people. So I just maybe wanted to start with, I mean, what have the past few days really been like for yourself and those in your community in the wake of this?
Well, it's a lot of varying views, of course, a lot of different agendas and a lot of different levels of expression. And for me, it's just been difficult trying to attempt to be a voice of common sense in the midst of what seems to be uncontrolled chaos. Many people are angry. The danger for me is trying to prevent individuals from using this atrocity and this horrific act of injustice as a platform or a stage to push their own personal agendas or membership.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's an interesting question. And I also wonder, just from a framing perspective, I mean, you know, what has the relationship been like between the police and the community in Tulsa? I mean, I know Oklahoma as a state last year ranked number one per capita police killing of civilians. So, I mean, was this something that in some ways, as terrible as it was, wasn't a real surprise to at least black folks in Tulsa?
Well, the statistics themselves almost answers that question. The very fact that this has become somewhat commonplace is not a surprise, but it's even more upsetting because after each event, there's almost a promise that things will get better. I think people are just at a place at this particular time. We're fed up with just empty promises, slogans, and being called to the table after the milk has been spilled, for lack of a better metaphor. The attempts by the police department to curb the violence and to create a better relationship with its community constituents has been marred simply because simple things like community policing or police being more active with individuals or walking the beat, and the excuse always being lack of manpower. But of course, we don't believe that that is the reason. There are just some people, because of whatever political reasons or personal agendas, don't deem it necessary for that to particularly happen. So the cry from the community to those who are sworn to serve and protect us has simply been, be a part of our community, get to know our community, or invite representations or representatives of our community to the table so that you would better be able to identify with the struggles, with the troubles, and with the issues that are plaguing the African-American community.
Absolutely. And you know, I wonder how you felt so far about, speaking of that point of people getting to know your community, really how the media has covered this so far. I mean, the one thing in particular that's really struck me, and I mean, I think as you and I both know, this is frequently happens when someone is killed by the police. Immediately, it's put out there that, you know, they were on some drug, and now they're trying to say that he is high on PCP. Obviously, we have no evidence of that yet, but nevertheless, it's in the narrative, and I see that everywhere. But what I don't see everywhere in the media was, I thought, just a beautiful statement by Mr. Crutchard's sister, where she was pointing out, you know, there's so many other aspects and facets to this man's life that no one is touching on. So as someone who's just there at ground zero, I mean, how have you felt about the way that the national media, which I'm sure is swarming, and hey, maybe that's me too, has been covering the issue?
Well, when you look at the pleas, the cries, and the adjectives and the descriptions that were made of Terrence by his twin sister, you see a side of a man that points to his humanity and just the very personification of who he is. Knowing that, we all have flaws. There are shadows in everyone's life. The problem that we have in our community with the media, and not just the media, but with the police department itself, who find themselves in defense mode, is that as opposed to just sympathizing or even trying to have a level of empathy for the family, in an attempt to normalize, justify, or make sense out of the nonsense that occurred on behalf of their partners or their fellow officer, the best way to normalize or justify their actions is to vilify the victim. And if they can somehow paint a negative portrait of this individual, then it would make more sense why deadly force may have been warranted. This is what causes us to be up in arms, because the first thing they do is attempt to find anything negative where they paint this negative picture of the individual. Now, let me be clear and transparent here. It has been affirmed. We're not sure exactly how it got there or if it was him. Toxicology, of course, and those things will give us clarity in the days to come. But it has been said that PCP was found in his vehicle. It has been said that this was something that may have transpired. That being said, it changes the narrative. Now those would-be sympathizers, rather, regardless of their ethnicity, those would-be sympathizers are now backing away from the picture that was painted by his sister that he was a good guy. Well, even if PCP was found, even if he was under the influence, it does not take away from the positive attributes of Terrence. It does not take away from the fact that there was no aggression. It does not take away from the fact that the windows were rolled up and he was not reaching for any weapon or anything inside of the vehicle, because they didn't have access into the vehicle because the windows were completely rolled up. Of course, all these facts will come out in time. So they're changing the narrative now with the discovery or the alleged discovery of PCP or drugs. But outside of perception, it does not erase the facts. The facts is the shooting was unjust, and we have an officer who may have had a perception issue from the beginning when it comes to this big bad dude, as it was heard saying from one of the officers in the helicopter. Maybe the perception was that he was a threat before she even took the time to ascertain what exactly was happening in this situation. And also, she is touted now by the defense, her attorneys, as being an expert in the area of detecting someone who's under the influence. Well, I don't know if that works for her or against her, because if she, in fact, is an expert of someone who's under the influence, then there should be a protocol or some kind of procedure that should have been followed that would not have led immediately to a fatal shooting.
Right. Well, I think that's a very good point. And I think the fact that one of the other officers involved, not that I'm necessarily even really saying this is 100% justified, but you have one person using a taser, another person using a gun. Obviously, they had some precondition. And the more interesting thing to me, too, is that in Officer Shelby's own account, in the part that's not on the video, she says that when allegedly he was coming towards her, when she politely asked him, take your hands out of your pocket, so on and so forth, he not only took his hands out, put his hands up, and then ceases to move towards her and then moves away. I mean, and so it just seems like in so many different areas, very strange, the story they're saying. But I think you're 100% right about the preconceived notions. I think the guy in the helicopter, you know, whoever that was, it is what it is. But let me also ask you this. You know, in the wake of the Robert Bates situation, and for those who are listening who don't know, Robert Bates was a gentleman who also killed someone in Tulsa. He's 74 years old, reserve police officer, big donor to the sheriff's department. That's how he gets in there. He kills someone. He's convicted this year of manslaughter, sentenced to 4 years. So, I mean, for yourself and for people in Tulsa, I wonder, I mean, does that sort of raise your hopes that there could be some sort of justice in this case, or maybe not? Because I know a lot of people felt that the 4 years for Robert Bates was a bit of a slap on the wrist, given what happened when he killed Eric Harris. So, I mean, how does that sort of legacy, I guess, of that happening impact on this in the community, do you think?
It actually makes it worse, because after the case with Bates and after he was sentenced, however it was 4 years, there was a sense of justice or relief. Because even after he was incarcerated, the whole sheriff department was dismantled, if you will. And the so-called powers that be who defended this situation, many of them was removed from the equation. So at some point, we almost dropped our guards and was at a place of calm. Now, we were still arguing for a seat at the table, because I'm a firm advocate that, again, if I can just use this metaphor again, being invited to the table after the fact, after the milk has been spilled, simply infers that our job as community leaders is to help clean up the milk that has been spilled. That's the only time we're at the table. I'm an advocate for a seat at the table that will help curve and shape policies and change procedures if, in fact, there was protocols that was not followed, or if a protocol was followed, then let's see what we can do about changing the protocol to make the environment and the perception that everything black is somehow dangerous. Let's change these things. That being said, back to the Bates issue, we had our guards down. We were somewhat applauding the fact that finally there seems to be a level of justice as opposed to being just us. And on the heels of this calm, on the heels of this collaborative celebration, if you will, now it appears to all be premature, because now that that has been done, you turn right around and here is another incident all over again. And this is why I believe the TPD and the district attorney, Cusswiler, and the rest moved so swiftly to invite. Now, this is brand new what they have done, to invite us to a table at the very beginning of a particular incident. This is all new. And this was their attempt at transparency. This was their attempt at transparency. But the reality is, it's still after the fact. It's still after the fact. And so it hurts us now thinking that everything was turning for the level of justice and equality. And now we find ourselves right back into this position again. So I actually think the Bates decision, which would have been something to be celebrated, is now void because we let our guards down. Now people are more agitated, more guarded, more angry, you know, and just uncomfortable altogether, because we don't know who to trust when everybody is saying, trust us.
Right, right. Well, I think that's a great point, and it raises the question now with the Department of Justice having opened this investigation. I mean, does that, you think, raise people's hopes? Or, I mean, sort of based on perhaps their track record in the past in these investigations, I know in Eric Garner, you know, they just sort of swept it under the rug ultimately, and his daughter has been calling for, you know, that information to be released. I mean, you know, does this seem like it could be a ray of light, or is it, you know, still sort of same old, same old?
It's a mixed bag, because there are many of us who want to believe. we really want to believe that those who are in charge of prosecuting this situation or investigating this situation are on the side of justice. I happen to be good friends with Tulsa District Attorney Cuswiler. I happen to be good friends of United States District Attorney Danny Williams, who happens to be a member of my church. I'm great for the Chief of Police, Jordan, and his the director, detective lead, Brooks, and the mayor himself, Dewey Bartlett, and even this the mayor who is coming in after Dewey is leaving in January. I've established relationships with all of these people and have been invited to different things. But a lot of it now seems to sound like politics as usual. And if we can somehow get a safe individual involved, he can be the voice for the community and an advocate for us all at the same time. I'm not interested in making someone look good when their actions is diametrically opposed to what I'm saying about them. I think what's going to be the defining moment, and of course this is with every case, it's how this young lady, this police officer, is going to be charged. That's going to be the defining moment. And right now, her defense and her attorneys are already trying to paint a negative picture of Terrence. And the more these things happen, and the wheels of justice have to play out. You know, we can't jump the gun, but we're going to be on pins and needles until the end. And if by any chance Lady Justice peeks from behind the blindfold on her eyes and decide that this police officer didn't do anything wrong, that's when you'll really see some civil unrest take place. I'm absolutely positive of it. We're trying to paint a portrait for the nation on how to handle these difficult situations and not result to what is happening right now in North Carolina. We're really trying to, in a godly manner, handle this thing so that we can be viewed as vigilant, as angry, but also as decent and orderly at the same time. This is our immediate objective right now, is to keep a level of calm amongst our community.
Yeah, and I just will say, maybe in the last minute or so we have here, I mean, are you expecting, and is this there mobilizing happening for people, peaceful protests, nonviolence, civil disobedience, whatever it may be, coming up in the days that folks should be looking to see?
Even now, there's protests going on at this very moment downtown at the state capitol. Tonight, we are hosting a vigil at a church in Tulsa, myself and other local pastors, and I will have a few words on behalf of the community there. And the whole thing is to give them an opportunity to vent, to remain calm, but to let them know that we're not just going to sit passively and trust a system that we know has worked against us in days past. We do know we have a systemic problem, and we want to assure folks that as community leaders, we're going to work diligently to change the process, the policies, and the procedures of this unjust system.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. That was Dr. Rodney Goss of the Morningstar Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He is the pastor there. Thank you so much, Dr. Goss, for joining us. We are going to take a break, but we will be back with more of By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik here in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around. And today we're continuing our conversation talking about police killings in America, calls for justice, and Barack Obama's final speech at the United Nations as President of the United States. And earlier we spoke to Ben Norton, who is a columnist with Salon.com, about all of these issues. You know, I just wanted to start with Charlotte and everything that's going on there with the uprisings and in relation to the killing of Keith Lamont Scott. You know, I know you've written about this. There seems to be, you know, quite a bit of interesting narrative there. And the one that's being sort of spun is that people kind of jumped on the police and victimized them. I mean, I just wonder, from your take as someone who's been covering it, what is really going on right now in North Carolina?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of the police story, the details are not entirely clear at this moment. The police claim that Scott was armed, and whether or not he was armed is still debatable. His family says that he was actually, you know, armed with a book, if you will, if he was armed at all. They say he was unarmed and that he was sitting in his car reading a book, waiting for his son to be dropped off after school. And his family also says that Mr. Scott was disabled. And the police have not mentioned this in their reports. The police claim that he was armed, although many analysts and observers have pointed out that North Carolina is an open carry state. So even if he was armed, Mr. Scott was practicing his Second Amendment right, if you will. And the police have not said whether or not he aimed a gun at them. So they were asked this question and they neither confirmed nor denied. The police claimed that Scott threatened them. But at this point, it's a he said, she said, and we shall see if there's any kind of video. But I think this is a kind of typical response. I mean, Black Americans are tremendously exploited in this country, and this is not the only case. I mean, the same day on Tuesday, videos were released showing police in Tulsa, Oklahoma, shooting dead an unarmed Black man outside of his car that was broken down on a highway. So, you know, this is by no means an isolated case. And, you know, when Black Americans protest the extreme oppression to which they endure, frequently you have people who are more angry about the destroyed vehicles and property destruction than they are about the killing of people who, in some cases, were completely innocent and unarmed.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very good point. And you know, I wonder just in the way often these things are portrayed, too. I mean, obviously, you've got the situation with, you know, whether or not Mr. Scott was armed. You got the police saying Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, Oklahoma was high on PCP. I mean, I just wonder, as a journalist, I mean, how do you think these types of things could be covered? Because obviously the police have the most information in these cases, and it seems that their narrative always gets out there. But there's so much evidence of the police, you know, using these narratives in ways that are abused that, I mean, it almost seems like the benefit of the doubt should be given there. And it seems that ultimately what ends up happening is all the information gets put out there by media outlets in some ways, but so much more credibility is given to the police. So, I mean, I wonder, as someone who writes about these things, I mean, what do you think about that balance of how to get the story right?
That's the crucial question. And it's something that I struggle a lot with. In general, I think it's fair to say that the U.S. media is overwhelmingly biased in favor of police. And it strikes me so, you know, odd how, perhaps not unexpected, but odd and absurd that, you know, the police account of the story is always given precedence. But we have many cases in the past year, you know, of course, going back many years, but we have many cases just in the past year in which police were exposed to have lied. You know, videos came out later that showed that their version of the story was false. The police claimed that this unarmed Black person was actually armed, and then video comes out and shows that they weren't. It's hard as a journalist dealing with these kinds of different sources, because at the end of the day, it often becomes about a he said, she said argument. And that's, at this moment, that's what we are dealing with in Charlotte. But we'll see if video comes out, and we'll see whether the police narrative is true. I mean, I think as journalists, we should always be skeptical of everything and everyone, especially people in positions of authority, and especially people in positions of authority that have a well-documented history of abuse and simply lies. And I think, you know, looking at a case like Charlotte, this is why in my reporting on Charlotte, you know, I discuss in great detail the family's version of the events, what the family claimed about the incident, because, you know, many media outlets mention the family's version, but only in passing, and instead relied on the police narrative. And this is ultimately a kind of inevitable when you're, you know, dealing with any issue that involves the U.S. government or any other government. And it's not limited to just police shootings. I mean, I'm reminded of reporting on foreign policy. And very often you'll have websites like the Daily Beast, which are pushing very kind of hawkish neoconservative editorial stances on foreign policy. And their articles will consist of anonymous quotes from DOD, Pentagon officials, and, you know, quotes from the State Department. And, you know, these are ostensible scoops that are, you know, whispered in the ears of reporters by nameless government officials. So I think, you know, this is a problem with journalism overall. It's certainly not just limited to the U.S., but it's unfortunately very popular in the U.S. And I think it's a kind of strategy that is in some ways irresponsible and one that needs to be reconsidered.
Right. Absolutely. Well, since you mentioned foreign policy, too, it's a good opportunity to take a segue. We had recently here President Obama give his last speech to the United Nations as president of the United States. Obviously, that has raised in people's minds so many different questions about, you know, what is Obama's legacy on a foreign policy perspective? And one thing that is happening right now that I feel like is significant, but I don't think is necessarily as out there is the aiding and abetting of the Saudi war in Yemen. And I wonder with everything out there about the Saudi attacks on civilians and so on and so forth. I mean, how do you think, you know, let's say 10 years on or whatever, maybe even right now, we should evaluate and fit that into the Obama legacy?
Absolutely. I mean, the UN speech really kind of summarizes Obama's entire legacy, in my view, and it shows how Obama is a master of rhetoric, but his words completely contradict his actions. And today, which is Wednesday, when we're recording this interview, Obama is meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu, the hardline right-wing prime minister in Israel. And, you know, Netanyahu has been gobbling up land in the occupied West Bank. He's been expanding settlements. He's pursued a very violent policy against Palestinians in Gaza, killing approximately 2,300 Gazans. And, you know, you can go down the list. And Obama said in his speech at the UN that, you know, Israel needs to pursue a more even-handed approach and not, you know, colonize Palestinian land and give them another state that they can, you know, live in peacefully side by side. So while he's saying this at the UN, he's meeting with Netanyahu and boosting U.S. military aid to Israel from $3.1 billion per year to $3.8 billion. So, you know, while we have infrastructure that's crumbling in the U.S., well, you know, students are, you know, their schools are being privatized and they don't have funding for textbooks. And at the same time, the U.S. is now going to be giving almost $4 billion in military aid alone to Israel every year. This is something that Obama has overseen. Obama has allowed Israel to continue expanding settlements without, you know, any kind of punishment, more than President Bush did. So, I mean, I think, you know, in many ways, Obama's speech at the UN sounds nice. He talks about diplomacy. He talks about the importance of pursuing peace in the region. But his actions contradict his words. And on the question of Saudi Arabia, as you mentioned, I think Saudi Arabia is the biggest elephant in the room that exposes how basically everything that Obama said is false. I mean, Obama talks about the importance of reaffirming peace and fighting extremism. And he has done $115 billion with a B, $115 billion of arms deals with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is probably the most reactionary country in the world. This is a theocratic absolute monarchy. This is an extremist regime that represses dissent brutally internally, that refuses to allow women basic rights such as driving, such as the freedom of movement, and many more, and is waging a brutal war in Yemen that has killed 10,000 people, according to the UN, with little reporting. It's been 18 months and there's been, you know, nonstop reporting on Syria for 5 years. But in 18 months, 10,000 at least Yemenis have been killed with little discussion in the press. Well, the New York Times editorial board has admitted that if it were not for U.S. support, Saudi Arabia could not wage the war in Yemen. And it's not just military support in terms of arms sales. The Obama administration has also been providing intelligence to the Saudi-led coalition. The Pentagon is also refueling Saudi-led coalition planes. This is all happening under Obama's watch. And if Obama were serious about what he said at the UN, he would not be supporting this catastrophic war in Yemen that, as we speak right now, today's Wednesday, is being debated in the Senate. Right now in the Senate, senators are taking action, including Democrats, against Obama and against a $1.15 billion arms deal, trying to block this arms deal to Saudi Arabia. And they're debating the horrific impacts of the U.S.-led or U.S.-backed war, rather, in Yemen and the, you know, 10,000 civilians who have been either killed or injured in the conflict.
Well, let me ask you this. What's interesting about it to me, or not interesting, but what, you know, I wonder how you evaluate this in the wake of all that, is here we are in the midst of campaign season. And, you know, you've got Hillary Clinton, who is obviously very hawkish foreign policy wise. You've got Trump, who, you know, is arguing in some ways to pull back in certain areas, but in general is taking a heavily warlike stance, as it were, in just in general, in the abstract sense. I mean, how, and so now there's sort of a meme that's getting out there that Obama will be, you know, missed in some ways by people who love peace because he was a restraining influence in Syria and in Ukraine and so on and so forth. I mean, I wonder how you look at that aspect as well. I mean, is it just false? I mean, is it an order of degree? How do you evaluate that?
Well, I think this is another very important question, and I'm glad you mentioned it. And I'm also very glad that you segued it by talking about Trump's foreign policy, because I've noticed a kind of, you know, discourse or a narrative that's emerged, even in some left-wing circles, that I think is very troubling. You know, some people are trying to sell Trump as a non-interventionist candidate, which I think is ridiculous. If you listen to his rhetoric, yes, he might criticize NATO in a minor way, which, you know, is sacrosanct in the U.S. And it's like criticizing, you know, a religious figure. But, you know, he might criticize NATO. But then a few lines later, he'll call for the permanent occupation of Iraq to take its oil. I mean, this is a guy who not only is his policy very inconsistent, his rhetoric is all over the place. And one day he may say, OK, it was a bad idea to bomb Libya. But then he says, oh, okay, well, if we're going to bomb Libya, we should bomb the heck out of it and then take all its oil. So I think it's very destructive, and it's a bad idea to frame Trump as some kind of solution to the extremely belligerent U.S. foreign policy we already see. And Clinton, of course, is the kind of paragon of this. She represents the neoconservative U.S. foreign policy establishment. And I think it is true to see her as, in many ways, much more hawkish than Obama. She certainly is. She supported the Iraq War. She led the NATO bombing of Libya, which has destroyed the country, and which, in a recent UK House of Commons Parliament report, admitted that, you know, fueled extremist movements and was based on lies about Gaddafi. But, I mean, that's another conversation. But I think the thing about Obama is we should not let him off, because Obama might not be as hawkish, but Obama still is he's still interested in preserving U.S. empire around the world, expanding U.S. military power. But the thing is, Obama does it in a more subtle way. You know, like many liberals, instead of calling for foreign occupations and invasions, instead he calls for more indirect means. So you can look at Obama's Syria policy. Yes, Obama didn't at least openly invade and bomb Syria, although the U.S. is carrying out bombing campaigns in Syria against ISIS, and the U.S. has special operations forces on the ground, and the U.S. has spent billions of dollars arming rebels. I mean, this is a narrative that's tossed about. People claim Obama didn't intervene in Syria, but the CIA has been in Syria for at least 5 years arming rebels, you know, and also neighboring countries, you know, in Jordan, arming rebels that go into Syria to fight the Syrian government. You know, the Obama policy in Syria and other countries has been slightly more hands off. But what he's done is, instead of sending in U.S. troops, he backs his allies, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, the UAE, Egypt, etc., in these various different conflicts. And in Syria, yeah, it's true that Obama has a slightly more hands off policy than maybe someone like Clinton would have had. But at the same time, in that kind of, you know, absence, although it's not certainly not a complete absence, but in the relaxation of U.S. intervention, instead you have U.S. allies intervening, especially Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, which have funded rebel groups for many years. They flooded the region with weapons, including arming very extreme groups. You know, Saudi Arabia basically created a rebel group called Jaish al-Islam, or Army of Islam. And this group is ideologically, you know, it's extremist, it's Salafi. It's similar to Al-Qaeda, but Saudi Arabia didn't want to be openly, directly arming Al-Qaeda. So they created a group that's, you know, not Al-Qaeda in name, but similar in spirit. And then, of course, there actually is present Al-Qaeda group in Syria, which is leading the policy, leading the opposition, rather, with the support of U.S. allies. And that is what was formerly known as Jabhat al-Nusra, which recently rebranded as Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, And this is a leading rebel group that is at least indirectly, if not directly, supported by U.S. allies. So, yes, Obama didn't bomb the Syrian government, but he's allowed his allies in Syria, but also in Yemen with Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and also in other countries, he's allowed them with U.S. weapons and U.S. support to take a larger role in the region. And that's just as destabilizing.
Right, right. Well, I think those are all certainly very good points. And I think perhaps, you know, similar to other conversations we've had in the past, it also speaks to the fact that, you know, it's not just the president so much as the overall foreign policy establishment, the way they make you fit into it to get the money during the elections and so on and so forth. And it goes even further. So as you said, there's always a lot to discuss on this issue, and we'll have to keep this conversation going. That was Ben Norton, who's a journalist for Salon.com. Thank you so much for joining the show, Ben. That's going to do it for today's show. You were listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.